Presented by DogNation.com, this is Dog Nation Daily, the daily podcast for Georgia Bulldogs fans. Here's your host, Brandon Adams.
Let me first of all send out a quick apology. We're not on video today. We've had a weird situation. I don't know, what do you call them, poltergeist or something like that, have gotten into our computer or what, but our video stream's acting up on us. So it is audio only for Dog Nation Daily today. We're not even on the radio. This is like literally back the way that Dog Nation Daily started as a podcast on iTunes and on DogNation.com, all the other extra mediums. We're not out there for you today, but glad to have you with us here on the program. Coming up in just a moment, a really interesting conversation with Seth Emerson, who is in St. Simons covering the UG Athletic Board meeting. And I know that may make your eyes kind of gloss over here a little bit, but there's a sort of like palace intrigue, almost like House of Cards element to what's going on here in terms of the power behind the power when it comes to UG Athletics. I think Seth is great at writing about this kind of stuff, and it's a really fun conversation with him coming up in just a couple of moments. As a matter of fact, I'll get to that pretty quick here today. Before any of that, though, there is this. I wanted to provide an update on a guy that Jeff Sintel has called one of the five most important recruits for Georgia's 2018 class. That is Trey Hill, the offensive lineman from Houston County High School, obviously a former high school teammate of Jake Fromm. An interior lineman that would be a big get for Georgia's 2018 class and a big part of the Dogs' future. And because he's so important to UGA, it was kind of concerning for me, some of the stuff that I read from Benjamin Wolk, who covers Auburn recruiting for SECCountry.com, but the relationship that Trey Hill has had and is still developing with Auburn. As a matter of fact, I brought on Benjamin Wolk to SEC Country Live yesterday primarily so I could talk to him about this subject. And, well, what he said may give some Georgia fans a little reason to be nervous here. Here is Benjamin Wolk from the Auburn perspective on Trey Hill, a player that Georgia really wants for its 2018 class. Take a listen.
Something that I found very interesting with Trey Hill and Auburn, he visited Auburn probably five or so times before Auburn ever extended an offer to him last summer. So that shows, I mean, when a guy's visiting a school that many times before he receives an offer, that just tends to show how interested they are in the school. Obviously, Auburn, proximity-wise, is pretty close to Houston County, but really it's going to come down to his relationship with Herb Hand, and as you guys know, relationships really are everything in recruiting. He said, his exact words, I believe, are, "I'm pretty tight with Herb Hand." He said the two of them are talking on almost a daily basis. Really, he talks with Herb Hand as much as he talks with any position coach in the country.
So, listen, I think there's an element here where you kind of have to keep it real. You know, Georgia fans obviously love Sam Pittman. They love the impact the Dogs' offensive line coach is making on prospects like Trey Hill. Certainly that paid off in a big way for the 2017 class, and the assumption is and the hope is it'll pay off for guys like Jamari Sawyer and Trey Hill for the class of 2018. But the part where you kind of have to keep it real is that Georgia isn't the only SEC school that's got one of these offensive line coaches making that kind of impact. Herb Hand, who put a really good group on the field for Auburn in 2016, is also a big-time recruiter as well, and kind of the Auburn version of what Sam Pittman's providing. As much as Pittman's in constant contact with Hill and seems to have that great relationship, Herb Hand is kind of doing some of the same stuff and providing some of the same kind of impact for Auburn. You know, at this point, though, it's probably also worth pointing out that while Benjamin Wolk does admit that Trey Hill does have a nice relationship with Auburn, he does kind of say some things also that I think Georgia fans are going to like. As tight as Hill may be with Herb Hand, as much as he's visited Auburn in the past, even going back to the time before he had an Auburn offer, this may not still be quite time for Dog fans to worry just yet. Here's Benjamin Wolk once again.
I don't think Georgia fans should panic yet. I think that Georgia still sits in very good position for Trey Hill, Jake Fromm being a big reason why, and also just the in-state factor.
Yeah, listen, so you like that. Even though that the relationship's out there for Trey Hill with Auburn, you like the fact that a guy that covers Auburn recruiting still views the relationship that Hill has with Georgia as being a strong one. And the assumption that we've all made that the relationship that Hill had with Jake Fromm, his old high school quarterback, who's now obviously a freshman quarterback at UGA, that might pay big dividends, including the relationship as well that Trey Hill has with Georgia offensive line coach Sam Pittman. However, there's also the point here where you also have to keep it real on this front one more time. You know, Hill may have a good relationship with Georgia, may have a good relationship with Auburn. Those aren't the only two schools, though, kind of competing for Hill's services right now. As a matter of fact, the doorstep to kind of knock to get in good with Trey Hill, that stoop's getting pretty crowded at the moment. Here's a little more from Benjamin Wolk.
Georgia's in good shape. Clemson's in good shape. Alabama obviously just extended an offer recently. So I think that there's a lot of work for all of these schools to do to land Trey Hill.
Yeah, so obviously when you have a good offensive lineman who's had a history of really pretty dominant performance at the high school level, you are going to have all the usual suspects, the big names kind of competing for him. When Trey Hill, you would expect nothing less than that. What I do think is going to be interesting here moving forward, though, is if Georgia's specific pitch to Hill is going to really pay off the way that I think it might. You know, Jeff Sintel also wrote about Trey Hill in his Sintel Intel piece at DogNation.com yesterday, which would have been Tuesday. If you haven't seen that yet at DogNation.com, you should check it out. And specifically, apparently what Georgia's telling Hill is they don't just view him as a center-slash-guard combo. They really view him as the guy that can play center at Georgia. Now, the reason why that's interesting is because Brandon Cablano is gone. The guy playing center for Georgia right now is not kind of one of those long-term, you know, centers that'll be a new position for Lamont Galliard. But also in addition to that, look how successful previous Georgia centers have been. You've had guys like Boss Andrews move on to the NFL, just signed a big lucrative contract to play in front of Tom Brady. You know, center is something of a legacy position at Georgia. And for Georgia to say, Trey Hill, you can be the next guy in that line, I think that's the kind of thing that could, you know, potentially work out pretty well in that conversation. Plus, one more thing that many of you are plugged in, do remember, another reason why the Trey Hill conversation is an important one is not only because he's a very good offensive lineman, but as Jeff Sintel has pointed out, the relationship that Hill has with wide receiver Kyrus Jackson from Peach County is a strong one. Jackson has said that he'd like to play in college with Trey Hill. Trey Hill told Jeff Sintel this week that that seems like a pretty good idea to him, too. They're both priority targets for UGA, and as long as the relationship with both stays strong, then it looks pretty good, I think, would think, for Georgia's 2018 class. So the bottom line on all of this is this. The competition for Trey Hill is still pretty intense. A lot of schools in the mix here. Auburn's making a pretty strong pitch. And yet, Benjamin Wolk, who covers Auburn recruiting, says the situation for Georgia is still sitting pretty good here, which is good news for Dog fans who could use some for the 2018 class. There are a few priority targets out there. Trey Hill is definitely one, and Georgia fans will breathe a sigh of relief the moment that he is added into that 2018 class. My name's Brandon Adams. This is Dog Nation Daily, the daily podcast for Georgia Bulldogs fans. Great to have you with us here on the program today. Looking forward to the Dog Nation invasion to South Bend coming up in September. And, of course, it's all made possible by R.S. Andrews. And, listen, no matter how hot it gets this summer, I want you to keep R.S. Andrews on the on your mind. You can keep cool with them because they are the guaranteed $99 AC tune-up guys. And you guys know how this works in the summer. The chances are that your old air conditioning unit's going to go out on the hottest day of the summer. That is, unless you get the guaranteed R.S. Andrews $99 air conditioning tune-up. If you get that, their clean, screened, trained, and timely techs are going to give your system a thorough check and guaranteed all summer. Don't let it slide. Call the ones I trust, R.S. Andrews online at rsandrews.com. That is R.S. Andrews. You can check them out at rsandrews.com. And of course, it's great to have you with us here on the program. As I mentioned to start the show, we'll hear from Seth Emmers in just a moment. Really fun, interesting conversation coming up with him. Before any of that, though, let me also remind you, now 156 days away from Georgia, Florida, the world's largest outdoor cocktail party in Jacksonville. Of course, we believe good Georgia fans, Gator haters first and foremost. Hope you'll get your Dog Nation Daily Gator Hater t-shirt there at shopdognation.com. If you do so, we will give you free shipping on that. As I said, Seth Emerson here. We'll talk to him about the UGA Athletic Board meeting in St. Simons. Really kind of compelling stuff about the fact this group, while it may sound all that powerful, may not ultimately have that much power. And if that's true, then where does the actual power reside at UGA? Well, Seth's done a lot of reporting on this. He'll reveal it all right now. Great to have him on Dog Nation Daily. Great to have you with us as well. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
From Athens and across the SEC or wherever the recruiting trail may lead, here's a DogNation.com insider.
Really fascinating stuff from Seth Emerson at DogNation.com, taking a look at the inner workings of the UGA Athletic Board here as it gets ready to meet in St. Simons this week. Seth is on the scene there for that. And Seth, before we kind of dive deep into what the Athletic Board is, what it does, or maybe in more accurately describe what it does not do, let me deal with the agenda for this week first and foremost. You've also written about this at DogNation.com, and it seems like when this group gets together this week, a lot of what's going to go on is maybe Greg McGarrity offering a defense for why UGA is holding on to so much money and maybe not spending a lot of that on athletics. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think think that's the idea. I don't know exactly what they're going to say. Maybe Jerry Moorhead is going to lead it. Maybe McGarrity will. I'm not sure. But they would like to answer the critics. That's for sure.
So I want to encourage everybody to read what you've written at DogNation.com because I think it's a fascinating subject, partially because while I followed Georgia football my whole life, this is not a subject that I know a lot about. These are not people that I know personally, nor do I know people who know them personally. This is kind of it's almost like a house of cards type thing in terms of, you know, how a major football program or major athletic department kind of comes together. And so the general gist of, and I want people to read it all for themselves, but just as a way of kind of setting up our conversation, is that while the athletic board meets, and while that sounds like this sort of juicy title, they may not have that much of either the freedom or they may not feel the desire to push back much against either what the university president or what the athletic director kind of wants to do here. And one of the reasons that you touch on in your piece is that folks just kind of like being on the UGA athletic board. So if you don't mind, let me start right there. Why is this a good thing to be on?
Well, I didn't get quite a handle on what exactly those perks are, but one thing that Ryan Skates, who's a former student member who is quoted throughout the piece, said was that his understanding is that once you reach emeritus status, which is when you've served three consecutive terms of 3 years, that you get some perks. And, like, for instance, you know, maybe the ability to fly on the team plane to some away games, like to Notre Dame this year, and stuff like that. And so, but people enjoy it. I talk to a lot of people who just enjoy being on the board, and honestly, it's not like you get paid a bunch of money, but you get to the front of the line. You get a little bit more access when it comes to the perks that come with being a booster, and you still have to donate money if you're not on the board to get to a certain point. That's something that is going on with, I understand, people trying to get tickets to the Notre Dame game.
Good
this
point.
Year is you have to have donated in a bunch of ways. Well, if you're on the athletic board, you're getting to the front of the line. You're going. And you only meet three times a year. There are these committees, but, you know, the committees don't often meet for very long, and this trip to St. Simon's is very nice. You just kind of get to be part of the inner workings. But one of the I've attended these board meetings for years, and the more I'd kind of thought about it, the more I was like, well, what goes on here is just basically pro forma. Is Greg McGarrity and Jerry Moorhead talk? There's not a huge amount of discussion or debate. We would go there to find out these newsy items about what the budget was going to be, and et cetera, et cetera. But I did have some people kind of behind the scenes push back on me, not board members, but other people saying, well, what if there was a more independent board that kind of held their feet to the fire on some stuff? And one thing Greg McGarrity said to me a few months ago about the reserve fund, that I've quoted it in the sidebar story, is that they're held to a certain standard, which I guess he will explain about how much they can spend reserve-wise and how a certain amount that needs to stay in reserves, and that's set by the athletic board. So I decided to kind of look at that and kind of, I guess, point out to people that, well, that may be true, but in reality, the athletic board will do, and this is something Ryan Skates says in there, and I see no reason that he would be wrong, the athletic board would sign off on them spending more if they really wanted to. Now, I mean, there's obviously a good discussion to be had about whether it's good to spend all that reserve. I mean, what if with all the cord cutting going on, these television contracts crater? And what if Georgia is sitting there, you know, the cat in the canary seat? I'm not getting that metaphor right, I'm sure. But
we get the gist,
whatever
though.
It is. Yeah, yeah. What if they're sitting there going, well, you know, y'all criticized us for not spending money. Look at us now. But that's something that may be brought up tomorrow as well.
So here's the thing that I think is relevant for this sort of rank-and-file Georgia fan, and frankly, this is a difficult thing for me to determine, especially after a story like this at Dog Nation that lets you know that the athletic board is kind of just sort of going to go along with what the president, the athletic director want to do here is that who is the power behind the power? Whether it comes to, you know, money not being spent, money being spent, Kirby Smart hired without really any sort of second candidate emerging and getting a serious look. When these important decisions are being made, you know, who is the check and balance for a Greg McGarrity here? Because, you know, it doesn't seem like necessarily that these are always just McGarrity's decisions that you know, that he's not seeking some sort of counsel on, and yet the counsel that he's apparently receiving is not coming from the athletic board. So who kind of is the sort of the power behind the throne here?
I think it's people who donate a lot of money, and that money isn't always, or that information isn't always publicly available, but they are very answerable to their donors. I remember a few years ago, especially their heavy hitters. I remember a few years ago, Greg McGarrity kind of saying that, you know, he would hear complaints from fans about X, Y, and Z, whether it be the football team's performance or something business related or whatever. And then he would go look up and see if that person had donated any money, and they hadn't. And he was kind of like, well, what are we talking about here? So I think if someone writes big checks and they say, I feel strongly about this, I think they're really going to listen to them on that. Now, a lot of people write a lot of big checks when it comes to football. So I think a lot of people had an influence on the decision on firing Mark Richt and hiring Kirby Smart without any sort of national search. I've always said I think that was an institutional decision. And Greg McGarrity was just basically the person who delivered the news. You know, he was the one
sure.
who drove to Mark Richt's house and delivered the news and was at the press conference, which wasn't the wisest decision in Greg McGarrity's tenure, and then was at the press conference with Kirby being introduced. So he's kind of the front man, but a lot of people were behind the scenes on that. With something like what to do with Mark Fox and the basketball team, it is more centered on Greg McGarrity, but I still think there are some people that donate a lot of money who probably have some influence. And with gymnastics, for instance, I think, you know, there'd be some heavy hitters involved there too. And I think that's where the power lies. The University of Georgia Athletic Association, just like University of Georgia in general, depends on donor money. And they are going to listen to the people who are generous enough to write them checks.
So let me ask you just a really blunt question, then we'll move on to a different subject. You mentioned gymnastics. Suzanne Yocklin, the famous ex-coach, is married to a person that's gotten some attention for being a pretty high-profile booster. Should we just simply assume that he picked the gymnastics coach, and for the baseball program that's also endowed by the coaching position salary, endowed by a pretty high-profile family, are they picking the baseball coach too? I mean, is it as cut and dry as that those kinds of donors have, you know, literally, you know, the absolute authority to select people for those coaching positions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think actually the way to put it is Suzanne Yocklin and Don Lieburn Jr. are in a long-term relationship. I'm not sure they're actually married.
But I
think it's hard not to connect the dots to see that Yocklin had a lot of influence on the decision that was made there at gymnastics. Of course, everyone will deny that, but they're, like I said, they're going to listen to their donors. I'm not as upfront on what's going on with baseball. I do think Greg McGarrity has a lot of power in his hands, and Jerry Moorhead does. I don't want to present the image that he and Moorhead are just kind of puppets of anybody. I don't think that's the case, but money does talk, and I think those people do have a lot of influence. It doesn't mean that they always exert that influence, though, too.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I got a lot of questions in our comments section we broadcast on Facebook Live about Yontay Maton's decision. Obviously, you've written about this at DogNation.com, too. It is final. He is coming back to Georgia here. And the obvious point is this is certainly good for UGA. But, Seth, I don't know how much you've, you know, kind of been looking into this, but it also sets up a pretty interesting situation in the SEC for this upcoming season where, you know, most of the experts think Alabama's going to be pretty good. Missouri's got a gigantic recruiting class, number one recruit in America. Of course, Kentucky will be what it always is. This could be a pretty interesting SEC in basketball if you want to fast forward to the winter, right?
Yeah, and a lot of people have written that this past year the SEC did get better in basketball, and people didn't quite realize that until they ended up getting the five bids and South Carolina makes the Final Four. Now Georgia didn't benefit from it, and that was their own fault for not closing out a win over Kentucky or Florida or South Carolina, only beating Vanderbilt among those teams that made the tournament. But the SEC did get better, and they'll continue to get better. South Carolina's going to take a step back because they lose a lot. Florida, I'm not as up to date on them, but I think they're going to be solid again. Yeah, I mean, Georgia returning, presumably at this point now, 9 out of its 10 top players from last year and adding in a top 50 recruit in Rayshon Hammonds, it sets up to be pretty good. But so will the rest of the league. The rest of the league has gotten better, and we'll see if Georgia is regretting not taking further advantage of the league when it was down over the last few years. But by getting Yonte Maton back, I think they're going to be pretty deep, and Yonte Maton gives them some star power now. I now say it continues to get back to how the point guard play is, how the outside shooting is, as important as it was for Yonte Maton to come back, and as maybe as a step forward Tyree Crump takes this year, I still wonder whether they're going to end up regretting not taking that open scholarship they had and giving it to some graduate transfer who all he could do is shoot three-pointers. Yeah. They really needed that. I said that, I think I may have said it on the podcast, after they lost to Belmont. They should have stopped a few of those Belmont guys and said, yeah, can you graduate and come here? Because we need someone who can just sit on the three-point line and shoot. I still think that's something they should have done. But Yonte Maton coming back is something I expected. But now that it's official, it really helps them going forward.
Yeah, I think that's a great point you make about the shooter too, Seth. In the limited time we have left, I want to kind of rattle off a few of these football questions on the basis of the sort of depth chart analysis you've been doing at DogNation.com. Let me start with the running backs. And you showed a stat in your piece about the running backs I thought was really interesting, kind of going to what UGA has published in its own media guide about just how different the sort of senior season performances have been for UGA yeah. running backs and compared to freshmen, sophomores, and juniors. And it makes sense when you think about the guys that have gone on the NFL, but it's still a pretty fascinating stat, which leads us to Sony Michel and Nick Chubb this season. Chubb, for me in particular right now, do you still think the threshold is open for him to be viewed as an all-time great Georgia running back when his career is done? He's certainly a very good one, and maybe he's already kind of in that all-time great category, but in terms of the sort of historic perspective, how much of a door like that do you think is still open for Chubb?
Yeah, I mean, that's what sets him apart is, and God help, you know, God love Willie McClendon and Lars Tate, who I think are the only two 1,000-yard rushers in Georgia history as seniors. You know, they don't go down in Georgia history lore the way right. Garrison Hurst and Herschel, obviously, and some of these other guys have. Nick Chubb and Sony Michel. I mean, Nick Chubb and Sony Michel could end up number two and number three all time.
That's amazing.
In the career list. In Sony's case, it is just by being around 4 years and having enough time where he was the main guy, like especially a sophomore year. In Nick's case, you know, he could get really close to Herschel. I mean, Sony would end up having to not play, really, for Nick to end up passing Herschel. I think he needs a little under 2,000 yards to do it, or maybe a little over. But those guys are going to really pencil themselves into Georgia lore. A lot of it will depend on how the team actually does this year. But those two, just by coming back next year, have kind of set themselves apart, that they're not just going to be two more really good Georgia tailbacks in history, that they should end up being really appreciated when they leave for being really special.
I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll do one more question for now. We'll save some of these others for a conversation later on this summer. Let me stick with the running backs for the final question, if you don't mind, because another point that gets brought up to me a lot by a lot of the folks who watch us on Facebook Live or listen to the podcast is the potential of there being an odd man out at running back, because you do have the two seniors who are so good and deserve their touches. And Brian Herring, as you pointed out many times, is really good. The assumption is DeAndre Swift coming in as a freshman is good, and there's also Elijah Holyfield in the mix there as well. Do you think there's a legitimate concern that there's an odd man out here at running back, whichever guy ends up being, and somebody deserving of playing time and deserving of carries just doesn't get his sort of just due here, because this is a pretty deep group for Georgia at the moment?
Well, the odd man out is going to be running for Texas this fall.
Yeah.
So that
That's
was
a good point.
That decision was made. But it still could happen. I mean, five scholarship tailbacks is kind of the norm for the time I've been here. And there have been times they've gotten perilously close to having to use number four and number five, and sometimes they have. J.J. Green, Brendan Douglas come to mind in 2013. They don't want that to happen, but if that happens this year, they'll feel a whole lot better getting down to Elijah Holyfield and DeAndre Swift. They won't have that huge a drop-off in terms of talent. They wouldn't experience and knowledge of the offense. But they're going to be deep at tailback, and they've, like I said, they've had some years where they've had to go that deep. They just don't want to do that this year, but if they do it this year, then that'll be a lot better than having to go number four and number five at any other position.
The UGA Athletic Board meets this week in St. Simon. Seth is there. He's covering it for DogNation.com. Hope you'll check out all of his analysis and the work that he's doing there on the ground. Really interesting stuff. Seth, thanks for talking about it with us here on Dog Nation Daily. Hope you have a safe and trip and make your way back to Athens here very soon. And we appreciate your time here on Dog Nation Daily.
Thanks, Brandon.
Let's take a look around the rest of the league. This is SEC Through.
Good stuff there from Seth Emerson. Appreciate him being with us on Dog Nation Daily, especially from St. Simon's with the important UG Athletic Board meeting taking place. Time now for SEC Through. It's brought to you by SECCountry.com. Hope you'll check me along with former Alabama All-American Mike Johnson out today on SEC Country Live. We'll come at you at 3 p.m. Eastern time on the SEC Country Facebook page. Love to have you join us, and hopefully by then our video issues will be taken care of. We'll be able to present SEC Country Live as you've come to expect it each and every day. Some of the stories that we'll get into, I thought it was kind of interesting that Brandon McElwain, the former South Carolina quarterback, has found a new home. He's going to play at Cal, and McElwain was, of course, a big-time baseball prospect, so he's going to play football and baseball there at Cal. And what's interesting to me about this is that McElwain at one point for South Carolina was what Jake Bentley is now. You know, Bentley is the sort of hotshot, darling, rising sophomore that's getting all the attention, all the praise for South Carolina. That's what I think a lot of us assume that Brandon McElwain would be. And probably some of us assume that Lorenzo Nunez, the old South Carolina quarterback, might be that before that. Really, the South Carolina situation is a perfect embodiment of what we've kind of all come to expect as the new normal here in college football. These elite recruits at the quarterback position, you might be wise not to really fall in love with any of them because they sort of rise up quickly, move on quickly, bright fires that burn out very fast. And, you know, these guys expect to play right away. And the coaching staffs that bring them in expect these players to play well right away because of the personal tutoring they've had, the 7-on-7 work that they've done. And, you know, we're just going to see a cycle where you move through quarterbacks here pretty quickly. And, you know, that's true at South Carolina. It could potentially be true at Georgia as well. You know, right now Jacob Eason's got legions of fans, and so does Jake Fromm. Odds are it won't work out at Georgia for one of them. That's just the batting average that's just true around college football. And the odds are one of these two guys, as hard it is to kind of imagine this right now, could very well finish his career playing for somewhere else. Georgia is not immune to what plagues the rest of the SEC as well. Auburn had a quarterback transfer. South Carolina just had one there. This is just something you're going to see a lot more of in college football in the years ahead. As a matter of fact, Georgia, you know, lost Bryce Ramsey this year, so I guess in a way it's kind of already happening to Georgia. Speaking of quarterbacks, how about good news for Mississippi State? Getting a commitment from a four-star prospect for the class of 2018, Jalen Maiden. Now, obviously, it's easy to draw the line here to how Mississippi State attracts a guy like Maiden. Maiden sees the success that Nick Fitzgerald had last season. If you haven't noticed, Fitzgerald had a really good year. And then before that, Dak Prescott, who had a record-setting career at Mississippi State, and then goes on to have one of the best rookie seasons we've seen an NFL quarterback have in quite some time. And all of a sudden, Dan Mullen sort of seems like a pretty good tutor of the quarterback position. As a matter of fact, that's probably one of the reasons why Mullen shows up on these lists as high as he does on the ranking of SEC coaches. It would appear that at the moment, Mullen is building for himself a bit of a brand as a guy that can develop the kind of dual threat quarterback that Fitzgerald is, that Maiden is, and that Dak Prescott was into a potential NFL prospect. That's a pretty good brand to have for yourself, and it'll be interesting to see how much Mullen's able to use that. And if Mullen, who pretty famously has had kind of a wandering eye, he's sort of shown up on the rumor list to move on, take other jobs, it'll be interesting to see if the success he's had bringing in quarterbacks will keep Mullen around Mississippi State for the long haul. A couple other issues I want to get to for the SEC through. You know, I have admitted many times before that Jim Chaney would not have been my first choice for Georgia's offensive coordinator. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even Kirby Smart's first choice. Before Smart reached out to Chaney, he reached out to Dan Enos, the Arkansas offensive coordinator. And I have said before that I think Enos would have been a better hire than Jim Chaney. There is, however, an element for why Georgia, had it gotten Enos, might not be in the best position, at least moving into 2018. Because Dan Enos has shown up on a list, Paul Meyerberg, writing for USAtoday.com, current college football assistants who've been head coaches before who might be ready to be head coaches again. And Dan Enos is the SEC name that shows up on this list. Enos, you may remember, was a head coach before taking the Arkansas offensive coordinator job. You almost never see this, but Enos was head coach at Central Michigan, but when Arkansas came calling, he left his head coaching position there with the Chippewas, I believe they are, to come to Fayetteville and be Arkansas offensive coordinator. So Meyerberg at USA Today says Enos may be ready to do that again. So if Georgia had hired Enos, it might be looking for a new offensive coordinator in 2018. Of course, some of y'all would say that they may be doing that anyway, so you may very well be right on that. One final story to get to. I thought Andy Staples had an interesting piece at SI.com looking at some of what he calls the pivot point games in the upcoming season. SEC games that he mentions, Florida, Tennessee, Florida, Texas A&M, Alabama, LSU, is those kind of games that could go a long way in determining how these division races are decided this year. And I do think those are all interesting choices. I'm not as high on LSU as maybe some people are. I think Alabama's pivotal game is probably someone else. But that Florida-Tennessee game, in terms of the chief competition for Georgia in the SEC East, I think that's a crucial contest. I think that Andy Staples is probably right for identifying that, and we'll make that your SEC through. Now, speaking of Andy Staples' piece, as we kind of wrap up the show here today, he does mention a couple of Georgia games as pivot point games. He mentions the Georgia-Notre Dame game in September, the Georgia-Tennessee game to start the month of October, both of these, of course, road games. He does not mention Georgia-Florida, but I think you could add that to this list as well. So what you end up having here is almost like three kind of tentpole games, one near the beginning of September against Notre Dame, one near the beginning of October against Tennessee, and then one sort of near the beginning of November against Florida. It's almost like, for those of you who grew up playing video games, the sort of three stages of a season here. Stage one, get past Notre Dame. Stage two, get past Tennessee. Stage three, then get past the Florida Gators. If you can do all three of those things, Georgia's probably set itself up for a pretty good season. But, oh, yeah, in between all that, you've got to win enough of the games to make those pivot point games relevant, and that'll be the real challenge for UGA this year. Thanks so much for being with us on Dog Nation Daily in podcast form today. We'll see you tomorrow once again back on video and back on the radio. Have a great day, everybody.